The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Living in a Christian World, is dedicated to the merit and honor of Miriam Bas Yosef, Mrs. Miriam Ghanem.
Have you ever wondered why we are called Jews? That's how we got our name, as Jews, or in Yiddish, Yidden, or Eden. So of course you'd reply that the source of the word Jew, or Yid, is a corruption or a contraction from the word Yehudi. We are Yehudim. And that's why in German we're Juden. In other words, and in Yiddish we're Yidden, and in English we're Jews. But it really comes from the fact that we are Judeans. We're Juden, Yehudim. But that itself presents a problem. When we refer to ourselves in davening, when we pray, we call ourselves Yisroel. It says, Sim Shalom al Yisroel Amecha. It says, we refer to ourselves as Yisroel, not as Yehudim. Why is it, or how is it, that we got the name, not Yisroel, or B'nai Yisroel, as we were called throughout much of Tanakh, but rather Yehudim? There are two reasons we find that we could readily explain why we are called Yehudim. This is always good, that background music. Because people who are descendants from the tribe of Yehuda, or 12 tribes, one of the major tribes is Yehuda. Those who would be descendants of that tribe could in truth call themselves Yehudim. Like that someone from the tribe of Levi would call themselves Levium. But that would be fine if we could identify our tribal origins. In truth, except for those who are Levium or Kohanim, that could trace their roots back to the tribe of Levi, very few of us, if any, could really trace our roots back to a particular tribe. In fact, there's a Gemara in Brachos, in Tezayin and Beis in 16b, just makes the statement, we don't know which tribe we come from Reuven, from Shimon, we no longer know. Yes?
Once the Shvatim
was separated,
the Yehuda
we'll explain this in a second. Rabbi Yochanan traced his ancestry to Yosef. Famous Rabbi Yochanan in the Talmud. There's a passage in the Talmud, there's a Gemara in Pesachim and Dalet Amud Aleph in 4a, that traces certain people just by their mannerisms. One could perhaps tell if they came from the tribe of Dan or from the tribe of Zebulun. The Jewish people are really a mixture of all the tribes. I just want to give you just some history why this is so. After the death of Shlomo Melech, after the death of King Solomon, in the reign of his son Rehoboam, there was a split in the Jewish nation. The northern 10 tribes became an independent country called Yisrael. The lower 2 tribes, Binyamin and Yehuda, with a mixture of Levium there, became the kingdom of Yehuda. So those of the southern kingdom were Binyamin and Yehuda. In the interim, before the final exile of the lower kingdom, by Nebuchadnezzar, there was a stream of exiles of the northern kingdom who came south and mixed in with the Jews. There's a tradition, in addition, that after the exile of the 10 tribes, this is by the Assyrians, they were eventually, or at least some of them, were brought back. And this is, and they were resettled in their former homeland. And these representatives of the 10 tribes went into exile with the body of the other lower two tribes when the Babylonians conquered the area and sent the Jews into exile. So we Jews are really a mixture of Yehuda, Binyamin, which was the main tribes of the lower kingdom, Levium, of course, and some of all the other 10 tribes. So we're never sure exactly which tribe to whom we belong. So to give the name that we are all called Yehudim, simply on the basis that we come from the tribe of Yehuda, is really not is not really historically sound. There's another explanation, though, why we are called Yehudim. Not because of tribal origin, which we are not, as we pointed out, we are not absolutely certain, but rather because of political identification. After all, the remainder of the 10 tribes that were exiled, that did not join those little that came eventually came back and rejoined the corpus, the other tribes, those are the lost tribes. And we are the descendants of those who sometime occupied the kingdom called Yehuda. When the Jews were, after the exile, when the Babylonian Empire was conquered by the Persians, and the Persians allowed the Jews to resettle, the area which they resettled was again called the province of Yehuda, Judea. And perhaps then that we are called Yehudim, as the term Jews, is on the basis of that. The fact is that we lived in the area called Yehuda. So it becomes really a political or geographical connotation. The problem there is that why has the name stuck so long? Perhaps when Jews were referred to in that political context, Jews who came from that kingdom of Yehuda, who had just recently been exiled, those who live there could really be called Yehudim, since we are called Americans. But 2,000 years after the exile, one would expect that the name Yisroel, our original name, would be a lot more fitting, which is really the proper name for Jews, rather than the geographical or the political identification of a kingdom that is long extinct. There is, however, a third explanation of why we are called Yehudim. And that is, it's based on a statement in the Gemara Megillah and Yud Gimel Amud Aleph in 13a. The Rabbi Yochanan says that the word Yehudim is a religious, it has a religious connotation. And the word Yehuda, as Rabbi Yochanan explains, kol ha-koifer be'avodah zarah, all those that deny idolatry are called Yehudim. The word Yehuda has all four letters of Hashem's name. And in a sense, it would be he who is moida, hoida, to Hashem. This is Kol HaKoyfer B'Avodah Zorah, the Gemara says, is Kilo Moida B'Chol HaTorah Kula. Person who denies idolatry is the equivalent of an affirmation of belief in the whole Torah. We are those who believe in Hashem. Rabbi Yochanan brings cites several sources where we find the term Yehuda is used in a religious connotation. Bisya Bas Paroi, the daughter of Paroi who converted, is called in Divrei Yom Yehudiya. Over here, this doesn't refer to tribal or political connections. It is really a statement of belief. Recall Rashi and Chumash in describing the origin of the name of one of the wives of Esav. She is called Yehudis Bas Beri. And how did she get the name Yehudis? Yehudis was not her original name. When she converted, she took upon herself the name Yehudis because Kol HaKoyfer B'Avodah Zorah Nikra Yehudi. Again, he says the word Yehudi has the connotation he who believes in Hashem. And perhaps that's where we were, as we are in Golis. In a pagan culture, the name Yehudi perhaps is the most apt name for those Jews who defied the dominant culture and who remained and adhered to their belief with Hashem. On that basis, I would like to begin to explain how are we to view the religion of the dominant culture. We've always had this context, we are Koyfer B'Avodah Zorah. We are those who deny idolatry. Is Christianity the religion of the dominant culture that we in America and Western Europe live in? Is that another form of paganism? Or since it does have deep roots in monotheism in the Bible, it's really a monotheistic religion. Or let me just phrase it just a little bit differently. It's central, at least to all traditional Christian faiths, that God is not exactly one, but it's more of a Godhead than God. There are three parts. You know, there's a Father and the Son. I don't know if I should keep on going here. All traditional Christians believe in the Trinity. That is part and parcel of the New Testament, at least from the writings of Paul and on. The ones who don't believe in Trinity are apocursum. Right. I didn't want, it's really time, really, this is really a class out. Jews are supposed to live in a non-Jewish world, and I really, you know, I don't have the time really to go through the origins of Christianity, but let me just give me 2 minutes here just to explain what do Christians believe. Remember, you heard it in the coil here. If you go through the Psukim and Tanakh, the reference we have for Mashiach would be, if we could describe that person, would be a modern day Moses. Be a Moshe Rabbeinu, a spiritual leader, a political leader, a military leader. He was the eventual king of the Jews. That is Mashiach. When we wait for Mashiach, it's not so much that you're waiting for that man, but you're waiting for the era, all that comes together with Mashiach. It's not the man himself. The man is a catalyst, you know, for the era. We are waiting for, you know, Mashiach's Satan, and there's the time of Mashiach, the time where the political situation of Jew will be much different. Jews will live in Eretz Yisrael. They'll be able to practice the Torah without fear. According to the Ramban, it will be more of a mystical experience at the time of Mashiach. But our hope of Mashiach is really from the Messianic era. And we view the man Mashiach as we view Moshe Rabbeinu. Not in the sense of Moshe Rabbeinu, the vehicle, how the Torah was given, but Moshe Rabbeinu, the leader, Moshe Rabbeinu, he who inspired. The figure that's described in the New Testament was not a political leader. I'm being very charitable here. Was not a political leader, and he did in no way fulfill really any of the core prophecies that are related in the Bible, except perhaps on riding on a donkey. Right? That he rode on a donkey to Jerusalem, and this is the most identifiable fulfillment of the prophecies. He was not a political leader. He wasn't responsible for gathering in the Jews, you know, from all over. He didn't supervise the rebuilding of a third temple. He didn't defeat the Jewish enemies. I don't know if you're familiar with the advertising world, but they're highly represented by Jews, at least those who are involved in the creative end of advertising. They're the roots of Jewish talent advertising goes back some 2,000 years. And you know, the saying is, if you're stuck with a lemon, you make lemonade. The Mashiach just did not pan out. And they created they defined a whole new role for Mashiach. And the role that Christianity created for Mashiach is he who will atone for the sins of mankind. He has a whole new role. Man, according to this, is tainted. All mankind is tainted by the original sin. And as the original sin of Adam and Chava, all mankind is tainted and will ever suffer because of that. And Tzudel Tzu, together with it, all the other sins they compound with it. And this person is the sacrificial lamb who will atone for all the sins of mankind and will allow all of mankind to go through the pearly gates and to go directly to heaven. Except there's one hitch. You will only be saved if you believe. If you believe that he was this sacrificial lamb, you will be saved. And if you don't, you will not reap the benefits of his sacrifice. That really is the basis of Christianity. And that's why it's so important to believe and be saved. You ever see these signs? You know that Jesus saves? Well, that's the reason. Because he is he who will atone for mankind, and they will not get any atonement if they don't believe in his saving powers. But one could truly ask the question, how did he of all of mankind become this sacrificial lamb? Like Bosat El Gaton, you know, what did he deserve this great honor to be the one who will atone for all of mankind? And the answer is, and this is something which the New Testament often quotes from Jesus, Yeshu himself. Well, it says, he is the Son. He is a God. And that's why, since he is the Son, he is really part of God, he has a very privileged position, and therefore he is the one who, by his grace, will save humanity. And that's why the whole idea of grace, and he represents rachamim and compassion, and because he is the embodiment of that, of this koyach hakaporah, and there's this power to atone, but only if you believe. So what they've done is they've repackaged this whole idea of Mashiach. The first one just didn't work. The first ad campaign just flopped, and therefore they repackaged him. And he was very successful, let me tell you. This one was very, very successful, this new ad campaign. And this was all done by Jews. And the only problem was they didn't do a very good job selling it to other Jews. See, that wasn't they. It's hard for one ad man to sell his product to another ad man. You know, it's just tough. So they sold it to working class America, you know, and working class Greece and Rome, and it was very, very successful. But for us, in terms of halacha, we now have a problem. How are we supposed to view their religion? On one hand, they agreed to the statement of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hashem is one. And they will tell you, they'll swear in a stack of Bibles, He is one. On the other hand, He is three. Right? Because He's the Father and the Son, and I don't want to say the other one. Right? The other one was responsible for the conception of Mary. And that's the... I don't, you know, this is too long. I don't have a... I have a few more shurim to give today. So, is it three or is it one? And really, and this is really the... This really point was debated for hundreds of years in the church councils. You know, what is the identity? Is he a man? Is he a god? Is it three? Is it one? They finally came out, you know, it's like the two sides were fighting in front of the Rav, and the Rav says looked to one of the litigants and says, you're right. And then he looked at the other one. The other one tied it to him and says, you're right. And as Rebbetzin says, how could they both be right? Says the Mestech Gerech. Says, you're also right. The problem is it one? Is it three? It's both. It's one, it's three, it's one of the great mysteries of the church that the human mind cannot fathom how it could be one and three all at the same time. That's the answer. But it is one, and it is three. And they deal with Yeshu as a separate entity. There's the Father, and then there's the Son. So how are we to view, in our dealings with them, are they pagans, or are they monotheists? Now, I would just like, just before we come to the conclusion of this, I would just like to, just to contrast this to our view of Islam. Muslims do not have this kind of a system. There is only one God. His name is Allah. And Muhammad is his prophet. He's just a Navi. He's a Navi, like Yeshayah Navi, Lahavdol, Eliyah Navi. So they look at Muhammad as a Navi, as a prophet. He was never raised to the position of God. You know, it's like this, I have to tell you this joke. I mean, this is, you know, there's a story that that a rabbi and a priest were speaking, and the priest was discussing about the inner workings of the church and how high a person in the church hierarchy could go. And this person was just a parish priest when he was speaking, but the rabbi asked him, like, what would be your next step? Like, how is it possible that you could become a monsignor, which is you know, a higher level amongst the priesthood? He says, yes, you know, it's quite possible. Is it possible for you to become a bishop? You know, a bishop already has a diocese and controls several churches in an area. It's probably an archbishop, because that's a larger area, and there's every level controls, it's like a general in the army. So, you know, an office that controls more men. You know, it's a real hierarchy. Is it possible to become a cardinal? You know, that's already one of the highest honors, and being in the College of Cardinals, of 71 cardinals. It's like Lahavdil the Sanhedrin. Is it possible for you to become the Pope? He says, you know, it's rare. You know, there's never been an American Pope before. It's possible. What about being God? Oh, no, I'd never be. Why? One of our boys made it. How are we supposed to look at this? The general consensus is there's a dissenting opinion, but the general consensus is even for non-Jews, it's forbidden for them to be practicing Christians. In other words, it would violate the seven mitzvahs of B'nai Noach for them to practice worship or forms of worship and sacrifice and the take the sacraments and partake and involve themselves in the mass of in a traditional, unless they're apocorsim, so the traditional Christian mass, whether they be from the Orthodox and the Greek or Russian Orthodox, the Roman Catholics, or again all the other Syrian Orthodox, but even if one would be a Lutheran or Episcopalian, those who believe in Trinity are practicing a form of idolatry. There's a minority opinion that it's not idolatry, but the form of idolatry that it takes, which is shituf, which is the combination of God, of Hashem, with some other deity in conjunction, and when you worship one, you also worship the other together, there is an opinion that this is not forbidden for B'nai Noach. For Jews, everyone maintains that it's a form of idolatry. And if one would be forced, to be baptized, to become a traditional Christian, or partake in their service, the universal opinion is it's Yehoreg Va'al Yavar. One has to let himself, Chas V'Shalom, be killed rather than become a Catholic or partake in Catholic or any traditional Christian service. There is, though, a minority opinion about are they themselves allowed? And the difference is how it affects us is, am I allowed to be a dealer in Catholic religious goods? Can I sell rosaries? Can I sell incense? Could I deal with wine? I spoke to an advertising agency in Detroit. He handles one of his accounts is the largest supplier of sacramental wine for the Catholic Mass, and it's a Jewish company. He's a Jewish advertiser. Advertising by us goes back a long time. So are we allowed then to deal with Catholic religious or similar religious items? And again, the majority opinion says no, we are not. We're not allowed. There is a minority opinion that says yes, we are. But the majority, which would be, if you ask a shaila, the halacha would go with the majority. The majority opinion is that we are not allowed to sell them. There's a Tosfos in Avodah Zorah that deals with the prohibition of selling them, a chalice to use in their mass, a cup, or to sell them incense. They view them as not only it's Avodah Zorah for us, not only it's something we can't be involved, but we are prohibited to enable them to participate as well. There are other perhaps contributing factors of a heter, if they could get it from some other source, I don't think anyone's contemplating going into that business right now. The story, I don't know how many jokes I can say over here, but there's a very cute story that when Jews came to these shores, and those, especially those who wanted to remain Shomrei Shabbos, it was very, very difficult. Because generally those, if they were not trained, it was a 6-day work week. If they had to work in the factories, that would be part of the conditions of labor, that they would have to commit themselves to work for 6 days, and it was very hard for them to get jobs in another situation. And many of them became self-employed and became peddlers, and just simply because they controlled their time and then their conditions of work. The story is told of one of those Jews who who wanted to control his fate, to keep Shabbos and Yontif, and he, in the competition there amongst the peddlers, was very great. And he heard that there's money to be made in Catholic religious items, so he wanted to. I don't know if he asked the Shaila or not, but he started involving himself in these items, and of course that he. Originally, he just bought the overstock of other peddlers, you know, that he bought it. And he started building a clientele and a business, and he built his business to such an extent that he felt that he could deal directly with the distributor. The only problem is he was a Yid. He felt very uncomfortable that a Yid is going to go to Murphy, you know, is going to go to McGillicuddy and, you know, and ask him for... He felt very awkward. On the other hand, look at that Machma 11, you know, he had to make a parnasa. So he called up the distributor, you know, the major distributor of Catholic religious items. And he asked and he tried his best English. Of course, he was an immigrant, and Yiddish was his native tongue. And he tried his best English. He spoke to the secretary, you know, and he says, you know, he gets the call, and the secretary answers, you know, hello, M&W Religious Goods. She says, hello, I would like to place an order. So he said, excuse me, so I'll put you on to the president. So he hears a click, and he says, you know, hello, I would like to place an order. I would like to, this is 5 dozen crucifixes and 7 dozen rosaries. And the voice on the other is, was willst du, big beads or the small beads? You know, it's hard to make a living. I would like, after this preface of, yes?
I just want to ask you, you know, the minds of, I mean, the way that it maybe becomes the other people, let's say that those type of businesses and want your services, like you're providing a service, like for example the raw materials to build them.
So in that situation where you're not, where they could get the raw materials perhaps from some other place, you are amongst one of 50 suppliers, the halacha looks at basically it's permissible. I mean, that you would have, you know, for that you could rely on you know, you are not, it's not just held in Jewish hands either. You know, there are heterim in that kind of a situation, even though you're aiding and abetting, so to speak, but it seems that that's not prohibited. Yes? Yes. That much you should, because, right, you definitely should in terms of... In all probability, anyone who's contemplating conversion is no longer a believing Catholic, and any is a lapsed Catholic. That he does not write. Okay, I would like to write before. I would like to list various questions in halacha that come up in Jewish-Christian relations. And after I go through these various shilohs, I'll leave the floor open to any additional questions. Okay, now that'll be the format. Yeah, halacha questions, yeah. The first question is, I'm going to deal with, are you permitted to enter a church or mosque? And does it make a difference what kind of church? You're traveling through Italy. You've just read that they've renovated the Sistine Chapel. You have to see what they've done. You've read about it. Can you go in to enter the Sistine Chapel? The answer is no, you can't go. You can't go into Dalat Amas for that place. Because you can't come in within, at least as a shayla how much an Amma is, but at least 6 feet of the place you cannot go close to. Can you look through the open door and see the frescoes that Michelangelo made? But as you go and it's something special, huh? No. It's forbidden to have hana, pleasure, from avodah zarah, even if it's subtle pleasure like viewing. And since this is all part of a, this is not art in a sense, you're not looking, you're not going to the Louvre and looking at Da Vinci's Mona Lisa, you're not looking at a piece of art. This is part of the church, right? It's considered halacha tashmishei avodah zarah, and as that which are the trappings of the service, and it seems the consensus is that it's forbidden even to look. To look at a picture of that may be permitted, it's not, maybe, I'm not sure, you know, because if you're looking at a video of it, so you're not there, you're not looking at it, you know, the light rays have gone on to the film and basically looking at a film which happens to reproduce the thing. So that may not be, you begin to nena from the avodah zarah mamish. It's really what they've done is, it would be the equivalent of an artist, a brilliant artist who's able to reproduce it and to show it to you, so instead of Kodak has become that brilliant artist. So the, but you're not allowed to walk in there close, and you're not allowed to view. However, if that would have been a mosque, or had that been perhaps a church or a Unitarian church, Unitarians don't believe in Trinity. They don't believe in too much anyway. But they definitely don't believe in Trinity. And you want to, and they have beautiful stained glass windows. You'd be able to stand 6 feet away and look. Because besides a church being a base avodah zarah, it's also a base minus. It's a house whose theology, whose basis is in direct contradiction to the whole basis of the Torah. The whole basis of Christianity is, in one form or another, is the Torah has been superseded. The Torah no longer, as we know it, is no longer in effect. The same thing would apply, it would seem, to a mosque. It truly is not a base avodah zarah. However, they deny the validity of the Torah that we have. They say it's the wrong Torah, it's been altered, whatever it is, and this is not, theirs is the true belief. Rav Moshe Feinstein, so, in a tshuva, maintains the same thing would apply to a Reformed temple. Because again, because the basis of belief is that which runs counter to the Torah. Therefore, according to the Reform, the Torah is a falsified document. God never appeared on Har Sinai. Moses never wrote the Torah. I mean, the whole, it's a base minus. So the same thing would apply. He has a very interesting tshuva, which applies here and, you know, in some of the congregations, where you have a shul which does not meet the halachic criterion of davening in a shul, that has a minyan though in the building that does. These shuls are traditional shuls, they're not apokursim, they have whatever it is, that they don't have a machitza or whatever the thing is, but these are people who believe, or at least the policy of the shul is to believe. It's not based on a theology which is antithetical to the Torah. You would in theory be allowed to enter the building, not perhaps in the service, but at least enter the building and to go to the room where the minyan is, which, if however had the congregation been of a different nature, you know, then perhaps you wouldn't even be allowed to enter the building. There are other on this issue, there are other factors involved of Maris Ayin. There are other things about walking into this building. Do people know? People don't know. How is it affecting? Because the shul perhaps would have put a mechitza in, but because the vocal minority of congregants who the politics of the shul is such that because they gave them this separate minyan, so they're quiet and everybody else is happy, you know, and you're supporting that. If they wouldn't have that separate minyan, though, that vocal minority would press on in the shul and change perhaps over the whole shul. That's a case by case situation, you know. That's not a, you know, so I'm just speaking about, so I don't want to go into the variables of, you know, this case versus that case. There's just a general idea that a base minus, not just a base avoid azora, a base minus, a place which denies the Torah, you don't walk into. If it's not a base minus, you're allowed to walk in. So basically you would be allowed to have another, in this building you would like to you'd be allowed to have another minion, which would have a mechitza and would be al pi halach. There may be other factors why you can't. People will think you're going to the other minion. You know, and I don't want to get, there are other variables which may change from time. So you can't say, I can't give a blanket iser. So that the blanket iser does not apply in that situation. That's a case by case situation. However, if we, let's say the extreme case is a Reform temple. Reform temple allows, there happens to be Orthodox Jews who live in the neighborhood. They want to rent a room on the side. They will have an Orthodox minyan in a Reform temple. You're going in there, you're going into the complex, you're just going on the other side. It's very problematic because it's a base minus, just like walking to a mosque or a Unitarian church. Can you sell property or a building that will be converted to a church? You're in the real estate business. I mean, you're not like the guy who's selling the rosaries and the crucifixes. No, you're in a kosher business. However, the buyer is a church. Here there is a Moshe Feinstein was asked this question about a piece of property. The circumstances in which the questions were asked, he allowed the sale of the property because they could perhaps pick up another. If you don't sell it to them, they pick up another piece of property some other place. You're not actually building it for them, which we're going to see as a special prohibition. If you're selling them, would be the life and death of the church, right? You know, especially if it would be a Catholic church. It's not a Quaker meeting hall that they're just coming together. And this is they're building a cathedral over here on this property. If you didn't sell to them, I don't know what they would do. They wouldn't have their cathedral. Then it would be a real Shiloh. Then there's a real question. Normally, that's not the case. You're a real estate dealer amongst five other real estate dealers. If you don't sell to them, somebody else will. They'll pick up the property someplace. It seems that itself is not prohibited. However, if I would be the building contractor for that church and be building a cathedral, that would be very problematic. Because since the cathedral, I mean, especially you know, if it's a Catholic church where you have an idol, I mean, which is halacha deems to be an idol. In other words, there's a statue which is an image of the founder of Christianity. It's in halacha that is deemed to be an avodah zorah mamish, and the housing of it is deemed to be a base avodah zorah. I'm building a base avodah zorah. Building a housing of a void is there. There's a question, even if it will be a Protestant church, where very often the beliefs are not that radical from Catholics. However, there are no images. So there's no idol, so to speak. No tselem that this is a housing for it. But since, and this is the question, is but since it enables the prayer itself is a void is there. Praying and calling his name is a form of idolatry. And therefore, I mean, there's a question that they would normally only do this service if they have the church to do it in. It makes it very problematic to be a contractor to build a church. Probably a Unitarian church would be different. You know, you're not building, not the prohibition of building a church. Even a Reformed temple, in other words, we're not dealing with anything. We're dealing with, there's a specific prohibition of building a base avodah zorah. Well, a Reformed temple is not a base avodah zorah. A mosque is not a base avodah zorah, not a house of avodah zorah. Building a place where they pray to an avodah zorah is a problem. Where they're praying to the Trinity is problematic. It's a discussion. It's not so clear because they're, where a place, a Catholic church, where they're housing in that building, the, you know, the statue itself is very, very problematic. There was, though, a question was placed for Moshe Feinstein about being an architect, just making blueprints for a church. So you're not the builder. You're just mere, you're a step removed, and as you're just, you're the architect and making the blueprints, making the plans, which the contractors, the builders, will follow. He says that's okay. That's not, that was not included in the prohibition. You are not allowed to build a Catholic church. You are not allowed to build, that's for sure. In all probably, you're not allowed to build a Protestant church that prays to the Trinity. A Unitarian church you may be allowed to build. You won't be able to walk in once it's being used for service because the theology, the philosophy of those people is antithetical to the Torah. So you're supposed to keep away from such a... But in the building itself, perhaps there wouldn't be any prohibition. Right. Next question. Are you allowed to buy or sell stamps or jewelry with Christian religious symbols? The question was really asked to a stamp dealer, by a stamp dealer. And many stamps have, in different countries, have Christian religious symbols. Ramosha felt that there was no problem basically with it. It was just for beautification. It's really, there's no sanctity imbued to these stamps. Stamps are even probably the worst thing, that they're stamped, they're canceled, they're thrown away. It was never meant, it was never designed to be used in a long-term, you know, type of thing. He says there's no problems. He is not sure that perhaps there's no problems in dealing with ornamentation which is not associated with worship. But he didn't come out with a clear heter. Many times people wear crosses. Let's say with the ones without him on it. Right? It's a sign of identification, like some Jews would wear a chai, you know, or a mogi. It's just a sign of identification. They're not very religious people putting this on necessarily. You know, it's a talisman, it's a good luck charm, or it's a sign of identification. He's not mat or selling those things, you know, he doesn't, you know. He does not allow it directly, but it's not so sure. Maybe this doesn't want to go and say that it's also, but it's not all that clear that it is forbidden, just simply because it really, you know, is not a spiritual, you know, it's not something which is used in the service of avodah zorah. But stamps is for sure, there's no problem. Next question. Wherever you shop or work, Xmas carols are played. Now, this is not this time of year, but soon, in a few months, wherever you're going to be shopping, wherever you're going, that's all you hear are these carols. Are you allowed to listen? Right. And if the answer is no, what should you do? It seems, well, you know, those who are veterans of shopping, or around that time of year, know that there are two types of carols. There are ones that are like jingle bells. Yeah, these are nothing, they're not religious, they're winter solstice type of music. And there are those that have very definite Christian themes. The only problem is they keep on switching them as you're going. You know, singing carols. Because if you would go and sing a religious Christian carol, it's really a form of avodah zarah. That's a form of worship. Shira is a form of worship. Even humming the tune, okay, that's when you say the words, you know, because the words is really, it's a form of davening, you know, of sorts, when you say the words. I don't want to talk, you know, there's a, someone told me, I didn't hear this, but I just give you a, the story goes, but the story goes that there were there are three rabbis together in a... I want to delete the names here. But there are three rabbis together in a taxi cab, and they were describing their youth in America. They're all of them in their 60s. And the two were speaking to, I guess, one of a prominent Rosh Hashiva, and the Rosh Hashiva, they all said they had gone to public school. And they couldn't believe this Rosh Hashiva also went to public school. And the other two are Rabbonim, they're also Choshevi, and this one's a Rosh Yeshiva. And he says, nah, you couldn't have gone to public. Yeah, I went to public. The Alt says that this, sing Silent Night. those who've gone to public, no, I mean, this is all it used to be. I know it could be now with the ACLU. It's changed things, but it was that those who went to public school knew very well all those carols. Lahaloch, you're not allowed to sing them. The idea of even humming them, it's a very interesting, Rav Moshe Feinstein quotes, it's a fascinating thing. We all know, I don't know if you're familiar with one of the great, I don't know what we call villains or personages of the period of the Mishnah, was Elisha ben Avuya, known as Acher. He was a Jew. He was the only one of his that group of people who went totally away from Yiddishkeit. And they asked, how did he? What were his beginnings? Where did it come from? And he says, and the language of the Gemara is, says, Zemer Yevoni leposik mepume. Greek song never stopped from his mouth. He was always humming these songs. The Maharsha, this is Rav Shmuel Eidlis, the one of the great commentators of the Talmud and lived in the 17th century, suggests that the songs that he was referring to were actually songs whose lyrics were idolatrous. In other words, they were pagan songs or Christian songs. The whole thing, what Acher was, but whatever it was, they were pagan songs. They had minus, the words, except he was just humming the melody without the lyrics. But the problem was, it still had an effect on him. Still humming those songs still had that effect. So much as that you shouldn't, even without the words, you shouldn't even hum the melody. If it would be played, if let's say, just give me an example, we gave before the idea, you're in Rome, you're by the Sistine Chapel, we told you not to look in, you go down the street and there's beautiful church music which is played, this exquisite organ. The halach is you're not allowed to have the pleasure of listening to music played on instrumentation that was designated for church services. I remember I gave this shir, I spoke about this in Los Angeles, and someone came over to me. I don't know if he showed me the CD. In organ music, there's much secular organ music. Besides church music, there's much secular organ music that was composed by many of the great composers. especially in the 17th and 18th century. Already in the 19th century, it had already moved from organ music, but many of Bach's fugues, and as much of secular music was played on organs, on instruments that were originally designated for the church. Today, it's very hard to find organs which are not in churches. I mean, who else? These are big monstrosities, these organs. And these are really, there's not that much organ music outside of the church that would warrant to build this independently. So many of the recordings are recorded on performances that are performed in church on church instruments. He has a CD. I said, can he listen to it? I'm not sure. It's not the original voice. You know, it went through CD. It's been changed. It's not the thing. But who knows? It still came from it. It's not so posh. It's not so good. Because basically, you are listening to a reproduction, and a CD is very, very good. I mean, it's digital. It sounds equivalent to the original. You're hearing church music, you know, directly from the. You know. Very often, just around this time of year, they'll be playing Handel's Messiah, you know, on church instrument. Besides Handel's Messiah, is being played, on church instrumentation. Very problematic. Just simply because you're using their instruments. If you're walking, but original shot, you're walking through the mall, they're playing the music, do your shopping and don't hum. And that's basically is what we're telling you. What? You can, do your shopping but don't hum. You've been invited to the annual office Xmas or New Year's party. Should you go? What should you do? First thing is you ask, can you get out of it? Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked the question about can you go to these parties. His response was he felt that it's a question of Maris Ayin. You know, that it looks like, since it's called, it would be a New Year's party, that would be one thing, you know. But if it's, you know, one gets the sense. You know, in the tshuva, he really was never to one of those parties. You know, generally those parties. I mean, it depends. You know, if the employer, the one in the firm, is really a newborn Christian, then it is really a, it is a, the Xmas party is really a, is that kind of a party. And even if you go, just to show your face, you don't want to get fired. You know, that's a tough one because basically. They really believe it, you know. It's like the story of the famous story. This mother complains to the Chassidish Rebbe. She says, you know, my son, Ashtetufal Togs, and he wakes up early in the morning and goes to the mikveh, and he says Tillim, and it takes him 2 hours to daven, and he's sitting and learning all day. He's not eating enough, what do I do with my son? So he says, what are you coming to me for? He says, I do the same thing. The Rebbe Fashten, er meint es auf ein Emes. He really means it, you know. You know, these people, newborn Christians, really mean it. You know, they mean it. Yeah. So the, generally though, if you're invited to a normative Xmas party, it's a pagan type of a party. It's full of preaches. If they can't afford live music, but it's good music, you know, not good in the terms of the sound production of it, not the quality of the. That usually on these parties they don't play Mozart and Beethoven. So. Besides any other factor, there's a halacha which is really not well known, and I'd just like to share it with you. Because of the destruction of the temple, There was a prohibition, we're going to see the questions about the extent of that prohibition. There was a prohibition about listening to live music. There's a question, does that mean, you can't attend a concert? Or does it mean a party where food and drink is served, and playing the music? We generally in America who listen to recordings and this take the more lenient view that music by itself was not forbidden, but rather music in a, in a festive atmosphere, eating and drinking. But if you're going to, and the only reason, la halacha, the only reason you're allowed to go to a chasana, which they're playing music and they're eating and drinking, is because it's a mitzvah, because it's a simcha shel mitzvah. But if it would not be a simcha shel mitzvah, you'd have the chasana type thing, but it would not be a simcha shel mitzvah, there wouldn't be a positive spiritual occasion here, you're not allowed to go to these things. You're really not, because it's zecher l'churban. It's a real problem attending a party where music is played and where food and drink is served. At push out the halacha of zecher l'churban. I mean, there was definitely legislation made. It's recorded. It's brought in Shulchan Aruch because of zecher l'churban, a remembrance of destruction of the temple, that one should refrain from that activity. So the office party, even if it's not Xmas, you know, it's just they call it a seasonal party. They don't even call it, you know, I mean, it's clear, it's not a, no one will even have a havamina, that, I mean, no one participating. It's a Jewish firm, right? And they're just having, it's a New Year's, end of year kind of party. But it's a preacher's kind, I mean, it's a festive kind of party. Generally, there's mixed dancing and there's, I mean, that's how these parties go. Okay, you're not doing anything in this, but you know, you're there, you take some 7-Up, or you sit down, or you talk, or you schmooze, you network. It's a problem, just b'shal tzad din of zecher l'churban. Again, in all these things, this shiur is really to give you guidelines. If you really have a particular problem when it comes, you have to ask your rov, because every shaila has its own variations. But I just wanted to give you a framework, you know, just in order even to ask to articulate the shaila. Right? But this is not, this is the final authority, but this is really to give you the framework, then you can go and, you know, case by case you could have. Yes?
What about a shul that converted from a church?
Oh, that's the next question. I have not exhausted my questions yet. Okay. You know, let me skip to that. The question was asked. Let me skip to that question. Okay. And then after that question, I'll just briefly run through the other questions I have, and then I'll open to all the questions here. Can you use a church converted into a shul? That was the question. It seems, and this is how the Mishnah Berurah paskens, and even Moshe's, if it was a Catholic church, and there was really a statue there, you know, in the church, then he feels that, even though there may be discussion, the Mishnah Berurah feels you should not convert that into a shul. The principle of the whole idea is as follows. What does everything that we're dealing with has sources and is based on principle, right? What principle does this govern by? There is a halacha which is mentioned in the Gemara as follows. Their halacha is something which was designated to be used in a pagan service. Or there was a tree that was worshipped. It was a palm tree. It was worshipped by pagans. They felt some spirit occupied this tree, whatever it is, an embodiment or who knows what, and they bow down to this tree. Someone, a non-believing non-Jew, went and tore off a lulav off of this palm tree. Now, in halacha, there is a, for non-Jews, there is a halacha called bitul avodah zarah, something which was designated for use of idolatry, could be annulled if another non-Jew goes and undesignates it. For instance, there's the question of a candle burning in a church. It's part of the service. Another, or whatever it is, the after services are finished, the shamash of the sexton of the church extinguishes the candle and sells it in the marketplace. He has been mevatel. In other words, he has annulled its position as thing of being used for service, and now it's going to be used in the general marketplace. Those kinds of situations, like the lulav situation, if you want to use it for mundane, normal, day-to-day use, you're allowed to use it. Because even though it was once an avodah zarah, if it became bottle, in other words, the designation became annulled, it is no longer considered avodah zarah, it's not considered idolatry, and you're allowed to use it. However, rabbinically, since it was tainted, and it once was associated with pagan use, you are not allowed to use it for a mitzvah. Therefore, that lulav case, you cannot take it for the mitzvah of lulav, and in the case of the candle, you cannot light it in your shul. And this is brought in halacha. You can't light those candles or once used in a church in a shul.
Yeah.
After the goy annulled it. So it's null, right. So I could use it in my home. But for a dvar mitzvah, I can't use it.
But before the goy annulled it?
No one could use it. You can't even use it in your home.
Is there anything that's malachim?
What? Yeah, but that doesn't, but a thing which is tainted is mos. Right. You're right. So, on this basis is the question of what about a shul? A shul is a dvar mitzvah, it's a dovership of Kedusha. It has been used, for this tainted use, for avodah zarah. Can it be, changed over? So the consensus is, as for a Catholic church, it's definitely prohibited. That's what it seems. And for a Protestant church, there's a machlokas, the Mishnah Brura based on the Mogen Avraham does allow it. But Moshe is some reluctant to do, but that would be the question because it never housed the Avodah Zarah. So that really becomes a question, but it was a housing for a service, which prays to the Trinity, so that really becomes the question here. So the Catholic Church is definitely a no-no. There are those who do allow from Protestant church. In any case, though, after it has been made, b'di'evid, you definitely can rely on the opinions of those who are mater, not to dismantle the shul and to use the shul. Right? Or if the shul was used not by Catholics or religious Protestants, but by Quakers or by Unitarians, or those who really no longer believed in Trinity, then again, you would be allowed to use that. You'd be allowed to use that church.
What?
Right. Well, a base minus wouldn't have been the problem. It was also the base avodah zarah. Yeah. If it had been a Reformed temple, and now it is, the people all did tshuva, right? And they put in, you'd be allowed to do it. That's from my reading. It's a din of avodah zarah. It's a taint of idolatry, of paganism. But if it wasn't paganism, the fact is, while it's in use of the temple, you wouldn't be allowed to use the facility, walk close to the facilities. But if it's changed, it's changed. You know, it's no, there's a special legislation that was made with Avodah Zorah. And since we treat much of traditional Christianity as Avodah Zorah, then Christianity would fall in. A mosque would not. This is a mushroom. Would not. A mosque, if the neighborhood changed, the Arabs who owned the mosque sold it to a shul, you could use it for a shul. That's definitely not. It was not a base Avodah Zorah. It's not idolatry. Right? It's a base. The fact is, because it was a base minus, does not prohibit it forever. It's just because it's a base Avodah Zorah. So that, because there are differences, that makes the distinctions. You wouldn't normally be allowed to just to take a tour of the mosque, you know. But now it's on sale. It's no longer a mosque. It's been sold. You can convert it into a.
How far do you go researching whether music or place or things
have stores? I would. Yeah, so I would generally say the Roy, unless it's an organ, most things are not, don't belong to the church, you know.
You don't know the history of the shul either.
Oh, a shul.
Who has to have that information or who has to research and ask that kind of question?
You would assume generally, I don't know this, generally if it were a shul is generally, there's Rabbonim there, there's somebody who is knowledgeable enough to ask the Shaila. I mean, you would assume, normally if you have it there, you would assume that it was done correctly, at least the right process, unless you know otherwise. You know, I think you would normally assume there would be a Rav there, if he's not a Talmud Chacham, but he knows enough to ask somebody who is a Talmud Chacham. So.
What? How about flip talking? Is the shul could become.
Oh, so what's the other way? What about selling a, can you sell a shul and make it into a church? So that's how halacha, that's a bezoyan, anything which is used for a dvar mitzvah and a dvar dover shabbat kedusha, there's halacha, you can't use it for a thing of bezoyan. You can't, I mean, you can't burn down a shul, Marshal. You know, forget it, even after you. And I mean, just you can't. You know, I mean, there's a covet you have for it, even though it's no longer in use. You could probably use it for a secular use, but a dover shul, at least directly selling it is very, very problematic. If it was sold, there is a thing. If it was sold to a stam, and then the guy turns it over, and makes it into it. You know, I mean, you have nothing. You know, you're not responsible for it. But if you really you sold it to St. Patrick's, you know, whatever it is. And, you sold it to a church that was moving in, is going to take care of your facilities, and is going to go into. It's a bazillion. You know, it's really it's a disgrace for the thing. Are you allowed to? No. That's a prohibition. That's a rabbinical prohibition. You cannot, because of the respect of the shul. The shul has a sanctity, and even after it's sold, there has, at least even though it could be sold for a secular purpose, but to sell for a pagan purpose, you know, is a bezoyan, it's a disgrace, which is prohibited. Which. I can't listen, you know, I don't, you know, again, I can only give you guidelines. All I can know is one thing. I had an uncle in Pittsburgh, my wife's uncle, who when the shul moved from, as the shuls moved, and the Balabatim told me the only way to sell this, the only way they could get money for this is to sell it to a church. He arranged by himself to have the whole thing raised to the ground. But again, I'm not the final authority here. You know, I mean, you have to ask the rabbonim who are on the thing. But that is the general rule. I mean, that yes. Yes, that's not a problem. We're thinking about a base Avodah Zorah. Again, this was the thing that we deem that traditional Christianity and the belief of Trinity is a form of a form of paganism. Hinduism is definitely Avodah Zorah. I mean, that's no shaila. That's glatt kosher Avodah Zorah. I mean, that there's no shailas, no discussions. that definitely is, you know, like, give me that old-time religion. That is definitely Avodah Zarah, Hinduism. Now, Hinduism believes in many gods. They do believe in many gods. There's the Godhead, and, you know, time doesn't allow to go through Hinduism now. But there are many, very many, many gods. Yes? Well, the thing we discussed, yet the Chazal can't. They discourage you from living in amongst people that will have a negative thing, but they can't. Halacha, you are allowed to live in a Hindu neighborhood because they didn't prohibit it. They would rather you not, but it's very hard to legislate because very often you just don't have the flexibility to live where you'd like to live. You know, I mean, so there was no specific prohibition, but it's definitely it's not preferable, and that's why they legislate to make it difficult for you to do so. And they would rather that you not do so, but they can't out and out tell you don't do it because very often you just don't have the luxury. Jews in antiquity lived amongst pagans. You know, they had no choice, and those were the people around them. Yes. Yeah, it really is how they. Yeah, they look at. See, you have to realize again. I'm really not a card-carrying member of the Catholic Church here. You know, but if I would be a Catholic, I would tell you the following. Right. They look, at least you have to realize, Catholicism or Christianity as a whole is really a product of Paul. Right. The Christians prior to Paul were halachic Jews who believed in the Mashiachus, the Messian of Yeshu. They demanded their converts convert al pi halacha. They demanded adherence to halacha. That was the first years after the church. Paul changed the whole complexion of the church. It no longer was a halachic, legal, but really it was the idea was love and belief. This is called this antinomian. It was anti-legal, anti-halachic. And he writes very biting terms about the whole Jewish notion of the law. In his view, this whole idea that this interim period of law was only meant until the advent of Mashiach. Once Mashiach, and according to their view that he died and atoned for humanity, a new era began, and Jews were no longer bound by halacha, nor is any humankind bound by halacha. Right, his death. Yeshu, before he died, was in this pre-death situation. Right, whatever, this 30-some years that he lived before he died. Therefore he was bound as any Jew. He was born a Jew, he lived his life as a Jew. This was only an interim step. He knew, but his goal in life was to introduce a new era where all of this would not be necessary. And therefore, even though in his own life he was a practicing Jew, from his death on, a new messianic era developed, according to them, that there was no need for halacha anymore, just believe and be saved. That superseded that. So we can't look at his life beforehand because he was in this pre-death stage.
I don't know a lot of people about.
You know that question is, what about non-Jewish funerals? know, that reminds me of a tremendous story that I heard my father-in-law in the show. There was in Vilna. Vilna was in the mid-1800s, became one of the centers of the Haskalah movement. And one of the maskilim, you know, one of these secularized Jews, died. The role of giving eulogies for them was not a, they didn't have a shul rabbi as we have it today, which a rav was a, was, you know, did, you know, had many hats, you know, he was a poisik and this, and he was Masada Kedushin, and he gave the job of giving droshas and giving his spadim was for a special individual who was employed for that purpose, and he was the shtot magid. It was the magid of the city. Role was the public speaker. He was a Talmud Chacham generally as well, but his gifts were oratorial gifts. And this and the person who gave the hesped, the person, the shtot magid, really had nothing good to say about him, and he was probably happy that this person died. He was a person who was a who really that the subsequent you know, at right before the Haskalah movement and its derivatives created a situation before World War II in Vilna. I think it was half of the people in the population of Vilna did not keep Shabbos or something. In other words, it was a this was the beginning of that movement. And this person died, and he didn't really have much to say about him, but he was employed to give a hesped, a eulogy for everyone who died. It just so happened that a woman, a simple Jewish woman, died that same day, and he had to eulogize her as well. And in the most flowery and glowing terms, he spoke for an hour about this simple Jewish woman. And after he was finished, he ended, and this person also died today. That's how we ended it off. So all his friends who came to the funeral, who expected from the shtot magid this glorious hesped about what kind of a genius he was, what kind of what kind of literary talents this maskil had, were stunned. And they were, with great indignity, they went up after the hesped to the magid, and he says, how could you do this? How could you give such a hesped? How could you eulogize the person like that? And he told them, let me tell you a little story. There's a story within a story here. There was once, you know, in these cities, we were speaking about a magid whose function was to deliver eulogies. They also had you know, for chasanas, we no longer have, that's not part of our culture, but I see them, they still have this. So they have bat chonim. There are people whose livelihood is to make an entertaining presentation with gramen, with poetry, with jokes, you know, in the, you know, for the chosin and the kala. Because of the cultural differences between the rich and the poor in these communities, generally there were two badchanim. The badchan for the rich, because of the culture, you know, the in jokes. In other words, there's certain things that you can only, that the rich would appreciate. And there was a badchan for the poor. There was once a chasana, there was a wealthy man, you know, who married off his daughter, again, to a person of wealth. And they were ready for the Batkin, who was employed for the rich chasen. He developed laryngitis. He couldn't sing that night. So they were stuck and were forced to employ the Batkin, the one who entertained at poor chasenas. Well, the one who then just did not have the right jokes. He just didn't have the right things. He was not that entertaining. It was a flop. And after the chasana, the rich man came over and said, I'm very disappointed in you. And he says, the problem is, I'll tell you what the problem is. I'm really a very talented fellow. And no one ever invites me to the rich chasanas. If I had more experience and more exposure, I'd do better. So the magid said, you know what, my problem is, I don't go to many hespedim for maskilim. Give me more dead maskilim, I'll do a lot better. So also that remind your question here about the Levias. No, but yeah. The problem about going to a Levaya is it going to be a church service or not? Or is it just going to be a secular Levaya? Generally, you have a priest there, you have this, who's going to go into pray and have an invocation. It's not a very odd, I mean, by the real Furuma, they have a really, there's a mass, you know, said, you know, by the, you know, that's, I remember hearing over, it was on the radio. Yeah, they have this whole, so you have to, I remember, there's a very famous manager for the New York Yankees by the name of Billy Martin. He's a very controversial figure. Not a very religious man. He died in a car accident, and he had, as I like turned on the radio, he had the mass, was in St. Patrick's Cathedral. And they recorded on the radio, they had what the hesped, what the eulogy of the priest of St. Patrick's Cathedral was for Billy Martin. And he said, Billy, church is about the last place that we would expect you in, but it just so happened this happened to be your last place. Yes.
Right.
Because then you're going to a funeral parlor, you're not going to a church, you're not going to a service. If there was a wake, he was a Catholic.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.